Distinguished delegates, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this side event on enabling environment for rule-based business investment and trade. This side event is held in conjunction with the Open Working Group on the post-2015 Sustainable Development Agenda and has as its focus the importance and the role which international trade law and trade law plays in the context of sustainable development. Without further ado, I would like to pass the word and the floor to our distinguished speakers, whom I will introduce one after another as we go. Our first speaker is Professor Roy Lee. Professor Lee is the permanent observer for the Asian African Legal Consultative Organization to the United Nations. Before he served as a professor at Columbia University and at the Yale School of Forestry and Environment. Before being a professor, Professor Lee has run through a very distinguished career within the United Nations. His last position was the position of the Director of Codification in the Legal Affairs Office. Before that, he was, amongst others, serving as the Secretary of the International Law Commission, the Secretary of the Sixth, the Legal Committee to the General Assembly, and Secretary of the Preparatory Committee on the Establishment of an International Criminal Court. Mr. Lee has received a doctorate degree from the University of London, a master's degree from McGill University in Canada, and a bachelor's degree from his native China. Professor Lee, it's a pleasure to have you with us. You have the floor.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to have this opportunity to present to you my personal views as an academic. There has been a tension or competition between natural resources development on the one hand and environmental concerns. And this has lasted for quite a long time until 1992, when UN addressed the issues together of economic and social concerns together with environmental concerns. And that was addressed in the comprehensive program of Agenda 21. But the implementation of that program was split into two. One track is the environmental track, and the other is the development track or human development. And now by entering 2014, both tracks realize they have achieved limited concrete results. And there's a need to combine these two tracks, address both economic, social, as well as environmental concern. At the same time, the MDG shows that the results or the targets has also fall short. And there's a need to have a new look at the development agenda beyond 2015. And thus, we have the working group trying to to identify all the possible areas for the future development. There seems to be two trends, at least to me. First is that we need to address not only development aspects, but also economic, social, together with environmental, and at the same time, also some of the political and legal issues. Thus, you see the agenda in the eighth session of the Open Working Group that relating to conflict preventions, rule of law, governance, and the post-peace building. And all this shows that you need to have a holistic approach to the problem of sustainable development. I will focus only on two aspects of the areas that I think we should consider further. The first one is the modernizing the trade law. There's a little doubt that trade law is important, and the purchase and provision of goods and services are fundamental activities in any society. domestic or cross-border trade and business transactions increase the supply of goods and services and provide fast economic growth, higher living standards, and new opportunities for development. Modern, fair, and harmonized rules and regulations provide a legal framework and order for the sale of goods, making payments, and dispute settlements. Laws are needed to protect consumers and providers and to prevent fraudulent practices. Here, UNCITRA has done a lot of work, and these are on full documented in its website, and you know better than I do. The point here is that even though they have been tested and scrutinized by all the stakeholders, but governments still need encourage to make better use of these tools to in order to enhance sustainable development. Now I just want to use one area to illustrate the issue. That is that e-commerce. E-commerce is no longer limited to the developed world. But in fact, if you look at the statistics and also reports from their area, it's more widely used in developing countries than the developed world, particularly in developing countries where they have no access to the banks. Because you in those areas, in those countries, the banks are usually limited in the urban area, not available in the rural areas. So there has been a great increase of use of mobile payments, mobile money, and the e-commerce in order to gain credits, to get information, and to file taxes, and to pay payments. This is not just in the fast-growing developing countries, but in many parts of the developing countries in Asia, Africa, and Southern America. One of the basic reasons is that e-commerce cut down prices, costs, and generate jobs, and at the same time also it improved the markets, increased the living standards, and able to catch any new development opportunities. In the Middle East, e-commerce is also very widely used, not only because of the popularity of mobile devices. They are widely used in spite of differences in political views and also the difficulties in cross-border transportations. Electronic device serves the need for that area. According to the World Bank, as the costs of electronic devices going down, e-commerce will have more and more important role to play, particularly for developing countries and particularly for those countries have lack of infrastructures and lack of banking services in the rural areas. But the wider use of mobile devices will have effects, good and bad. The key is to facilitate the good points, the good effects, and to prevent bad effects. And here, attention has to be drawn to the problem of cybersecurity. And in order to have the maximize of the protection to the consumers and providers, and to minimize fraudulent practices. And here's an area I think the WOP may wish to address in its future agenda. Now, many of the commercial laws, the trade laws, are behind reality. Some do not apply to e-commerce. and they need to be updated. And here again, UNCTAD has produced very relevant instruments, and they should be taken into account. And states, governments should take the steps, necessary steps, identify what they want, and use the UNCTAD instruments as a cue. I should like to also mention that there is a need to remove some of the barriers. When the laws are outdated, then you create barriers to efficiency and to transactions and cost more. So therefore, it's important to improve the efficiency and modernize the law and harmonize any conflict in order to be to cut down costs and to catch the responsive to opportunities. Here again is an issue that I think the OWP should take into account. Now I turn to another aspect, that is that about the prevention of conflicts. And this subject, conflict prevention, is a main issue on the agenda of the before the Open Working Group. Conflicts of any type, armed or otherwise, will affect development and trade. And here we have a long list of means for settlement of disputes provided in the Charter, ranging from conciliation, negotiation, arbitration, or going to judicial settlement. And also throughout the years, we have created many international mechanisms for settlement of disputes. But the problem is that the record for the usage is rather low. Here, let me congratulate you. I think the in the area of trade, commerce, and investment, this is has a far more better record than any other areas, even though I think our colleagues will speak on that, and that there's an area that's desirable to improve the environment in order to settle disputes in those areas. I think if you look at in areas of development of natural resources, disputes relating to territories and so on, then the record shows that there are more disputes outside the existing mechanisms than those are dealt with by the existing mechanisms. So there is a need somehow to facilitate the process. Now, the real issue seems to be that parties in dispute are reluctant to take the first step or to initiate a process because they fear that taking the first step might give the wrong impression, might create the impression that they want to avoid, like to anxious to settle. And therefore, the wait and see is the general proposition. And now, if these are the reasons, I think then a neutral third-party facilitator could provide some useful assistance. On this initiative, a neutral facilitator would confidentially approach both sides when, in its view, the possibility of dispute between the parties is likely. On the basis of its findings, the facilitator would, again on a confidential basis, recommend a suitable means to entice the parties. If this method does not work, it will propose another. The facilitator would continue to make suggestions, again in confidence, until the parties are willing to engage. This method of using third party to provide initiatives is far more efficient, in my view, than waiting for the parties themselves to take the initiative. I think this also has a role not just in those areas, more sensitive areas, but also a role in even in investment, enabling the environment. It is also critical that the whole process from beginning to end would be initiated by and under the sole responsibility of the facilitator, who would reveal to no one its initiatives, plans, or approaches, keeping the work of the facilitator in complete secrecy and confidentiality is essential to protect the parties from external influence or interference. Conflicts are inherent in any development activities as long as stakeholders have different interests or concerns. Every effort should therefore be made to address the causes as early as possible. This is another good reason for quiet diplomacy and the low-cost and low-key approach. Now, needless to say that even though this idea might appear appealing in the first instance, and there are many things to be done. Implementation issues have to be dealt with. But a 1,000-mile journey begins with the first step. Perhaps the Open Working Group may find this idea interesting and take further steps. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Professor Lee, for these important messages to the Open Working Group. Unless there is an immediate request for the floor to clarify, to raise questions for clarification, I would suggest that we pass on to our next speaker, Judith Arenas. She is the Deputy Permanent Observer from the International Development Law Organization. As you know, the IDLO, the International Development Law Organization, is the only intergovernmental organization focusing exclusively on the promotion and implementation of rule of law. Judith Arenas is an executive director for external relations, and so she is active in positioning the organization in its external relations. Before joining IDLO, Judith was a vice president to APCO Worldwide, and even before that, she was for almost 10 years working with Amnesty International, amongst others, as the chef de cabinet to its secretary general. Judith, it's a pleasure to have you. You have the floor.
Thank you very much, and I would like to thank the other co-organizers for really bringing this very important issue to this debate and to this session of the Open Working Group. No matter where in the development spectrum a particular country stands, whether it's about establishing peace, coming out of economic or political crisis, or encouraging economic opportunity, it needs good laws and regulations that are fairly administered by transparent and accountable institutions and that produce fair outcomes for all. Legal and judicial institutions are essential building blocks for peace, security, and stability. It's no mere coincidence that post-conflict countries are actually amongst the poorest, or that the poorest neighborhoods, even in wealthy countries, are also the ones most likely to suffer from crime and violence. Insecurity drives poverty, and we see insecurity and violence thrive in the absence of the rule of law. When institutions are not strong enough to resolve social or political conflict or tackle organized crime, across the world, we have all seen in our TV screens people go out into the streets because of the lack of opportunity. Nothing stresses the link between the topic that we're discussing today and those images of demonstrators that have shaken the world, and this has often been sparked by the lack of jobs. Inclusive growth that promotes jobs is being seen as a priority for the post-2015 development agenda. And we firmly believe that the rule of law can be used to promote economic opportunity for poor people with targets and indicators responsive to local market conditions, for instance, on microcredit regulation or the simplification of licensing for small businesses or alternate, inexpensive, and speedy forms of dispute resolution. For natural resource management, for example, integrating the rule of law in the post-2015 agenda might mean referencing the rights of indigenous communities and the principle of prior informed consent. But there are a couple of other principles that I think are actually critical to our discussion that I'd like to bring out, because I think they help set out the importance of the contribution of the rule of law. First of all, the rule of law is an enabler of development. It actually helps to create the conditions for development. For instance, by establishing institutions for promoting security or tackling crime, or for setting the appropriate legal framework for business and investment. Secondly, it is actually an integral part of the development process when it determines how rules are made or enforced, or disputes are resolved to fight anything that goes from equitable access to health, education, jobs, or even in pure business settings, resolution dispute. Thirdly, the rule of law is actually an outcome of development. It's a political and a legal order with laws and institutions based on internationally recognized and nationally owned values and principles. And I would like to stress that point because I think as we all discuss what a post-2015 development agenda may look like, we cannot forget that we have an existing legacy to draw upon. There are international standards, international laws. Many trade treaties have been negotiated, not just at the bilateral level, amongst different regional groupings as well. We have jurisprudence that exists. We have laws that have been implemented at the international, at the national, and at the local level. We have the ILO norms. There is a body of reference that we must remind ourselves that exists, and it's not about creating everything from scratch. But in short, I think when we're actually discussing the topic at hand, we can't forget that the rule of law actually levels the playing field. Where the rule of law is actually respected, it creates an environment where private actors are willing to go, it creates jobs and economic opportunity, and it creates certainty that redress is possible. And this is all centrally linked to a more equitable and fairer world. Again, I'm grateful that UNCITRAL has taken the lead to organize this side event because it addresses an issue that's very important to the development agenda. How do we create an enabling environment for rule-based business, investment, and trade? It's important to recall that commercial law can actually be an important tool to address the sustainable development challenges. As has been discussed earlier, an outdated commercial framework can actually be a major impediment for sustainable development. It creates barriers to formalization of the informal sector of the economy. Inclusive finance, innovation, new economic opportunities, public expenditure efficiency and savings. And in the end, such a framework does actually not allow states to achieve effective mobilization of resources for sustainable development because private investment isn't coming, because tax revenues are not being properly applied, or because development assistance is actually being called into question. We firmly believe that without an enabling rule-based environment for business, investment, and trade, the world cannot tackle development challenges such as joblessness, youth unemployment, and the shortcomings of a large informal agenda economy. For a global sustainable development agenda that includes goals and targets towards creating jobs, sustainable livelihoods, and equitable growth, a rule-based enabling business environment is actually extremely important. The rule of law hinges on various universal principles. First, that government and its officials and agents are accountable under the law. Second, that the laws are clear, publicized, stable, and fair, and protect fundamental rights. Third, the process by which laws are enacted, administered, and enforced is accessible, fair, and efficient. And fourth, that justice is actually delivered by competent, ethical, and independent representatives and neutrals who are of sufficient number, have adequate resources, and reflect the makeup of the communities that they serve. As we have argued together with others in the World Bank's legal review, a further principle that regulatory and institutional reforms should be coherent and participatory across sectors, integrating social, economic, and environmental considerations to meet the sustainable development needs of present and future generations can also be underscored in this respect. Across our work around the world, we have actually found that strong dispute resolution mechanisms are a cornerstone of a stable environment conducive to private investment and entrepreneurship, which are critical for countries in early stages of economic development, and I would actually argue for all countries. A just and effective judiciary and availability of credible alternative dispute resolutions are crucial for attracting foreign and large-scale investment, as well as for promoting local, medium, and small-sized enterprises. And I wanted to just mention some of the work that we have done in Mongolia, a country that everyone has actually been worried will fall prey to the resource curse, where we have worked to strengthen simultaneously the formal justice sector capacity in commercial litigation, and at the same time to develop alternative dispute resolution mechanisms for commercial disputes. Since 2012, in partnership with EBRD, we've been addressing the weaknesses of the justice sector capacity to deal with commercial dispute resolution by training the entire judicial corps on critical topics such as the most relevant aspects of mining law, which is a dominant sector of their economy. We've looked at insurance law, which supports sustainable business development, and shareholder rights, which actually helps ensure robust investment conditions. And I'd be happy to provide more information about that. Another aspect that we've found quite interesting is the potential growth that comes from fair trade and other sustainably certified production initiatives. It's anticipated that these systems are experiencing double or even triple-digit growth, worth up to $31.6 billion. But in order to be able to access the market and development premiums for such initiatives, there's a strong need for local and national regulatory frameworks which foster, rather than frustrate, the achievement and maintenance of fair trade and other sustainable production system certification. With the support of the Italian government, IDLO recently completed an assessment, together with indigenous communities and local food security and fair trade partner organization in the Andes region of Ecuador. This participatory research revealed the need for reliable, rules-based local and national social and environmental regulatory frameworks that would stimulate domestic fair trade markets and would ensure greater equity for smallholder producers. We have been working with the community so that they can finally start to invest, for instance, through rotating credit and saving associations of indigenous women, in their own sustainable production and fair trade efforts, accessing new markets and new opportunities for sustainable growth. Further, a cornerstone of enabling requirement for rule-based business is the commitment of the local stakeholders to fight corruption within their institutions. One example is the commitment of several Central Asian countries where we work, such as Kyrgyzstan, to adopt anti-corruption justice sector reform strategies. A crucial element of fighting corruption within the judicial system lies in a fair and merit-based judicial selection process, the process of transferring from an ad hoc arbitrary system to a transparent selection and pre-service training is a complex undertaking that we've been working with the Kyrgyz stakeholders throughout the justice system and civil society to deliver this. These are just some of the examples of our work in emerging economies and developing countries that we help, that I hope demonstrate the complexity and the importance of this issue. As we work together to build rules-based regulatory environments which can facilitate and encourage commercial trade and investment opportunities, it's critical to recognize that both the process and the substance of the rules matter. In our eagerness to take down hidden barriers, we can never forget that our rules-based system can and must include respect for universal human rights and for environmental standards in an appropriate manner that's tailored to local legal systems. Commercial law, depending on how it is drafted, can promote local productivity or it can make one's local market less competitive. It may create practical mechanisms to ensure accountability, or it may only give the impression that it does so. It can create market incentives for corporate responsibility and good governance, or it can promote fraudulent activities. So governments must be equipped with knowledge and tools to utilize this powerful tool properly for sustainable development. Without continuous attention of global and local leaders to this field, the envisaged potential of the private sector to contribute to sustainable development cannot be fully realized. Continuous attention to this field is required since, unlike other areas of law, commercial law constantly evolves in response to new business practices and local and global challenges. This necessitates building local capacity to engage in commercial law reforms to keep pace with the developments in finance and commerce and to address sustainable development challenges. We know from our work around the world that the rule of law can play a crucial role in closing the gap between the promise of development and the reality of deprivation and discrimination. Good laws and regulations, fairly administered by responsive and accountable institutions, can transform societies, especially when such measures are accompanied by the legal empowerment of citizens and full participation of civil society. Bringing the law closer to the people is key to promoting sustainable and inclusive development, and furthering a culture of justice based on the rule of law is essential for a safer and fairer world. We hope that this message will come across clearly in any post-2015 development agenda. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions at this stage? If that is not the case, we would turn to our next speaker, Luis Cantro. Welcome. Luis is the ICC permanent representative to the United Nations. She has held that position since 2007. Before, she has been an executive director to the International League of Human Rights, one of the oldest human rights organizations in the United States. She has also held the position of senior advisor to the United Nations Population Fund and she has been a director of operations at the Population Council. Luis Cantro holds a doctorate a doctorate and a master's degree in demography and economics from the University of Pennsylvania, and a bachelor's degree in sociology from the University of Michigan. It's an honor to have you here. You have the floor.
Thank you so much, Michael. And I want to join my other co-panelists in really saluting UNCITRAL in being the lead organizer and bringing us along to host this side event on the margins of the 8th session of the Open Working Group. I'm going to focus my remarks this morning on the business and industry support to the issues being raised here in terms of the enabling environment, the rule of law, and governance. This is something that business and industry has embraced, and I wanted to discuss with you how we hope to bring it to the discussion and raise its profile within the context of the setting, the post-2015 development agenda. Let me just, by way of introduction, tell you a few things about the International Chamber of Commerce, which was started in 1919 by private sector representatives in 5 countries. And today it is the largest, most representative business organization, encompassing some 6.5 million businesses in every region of the world through our global networks of over 130 national committees and encompassing some in over 200 countries and through our World Chambers Federation. Our main activities are rule setting, dispute resolution, and policy dialogue. Very early on, the founders of the International Chamber of Commerce recognized the importance of business engagement with government. We were very active in the League of Nations and very supportive of the founding of the United Nations. In fact, we were the second organization to be granted consultative status through ECOSOC in 1946. So we have, through this long history, we have been bringing the balanced voice of business to the intergovernmental processes. We like to say that our history with UNCITRAL goes way back. And in fact, it was through a draft resolution to ECOSOC that led to the New York Convention, that led to the launching of UNCITRAL, and we have worked closely with them throughout this long history. So we're, again, very, very pleased to be partners once again in trying to bring these issues, these important sets of issues about rule of law and governance in terms of a post-2015 development agenda. Also, business and industry has been engaging in this post-2015 development process. Coming out of Rio, there was a very strong understanding that the United Nations was going to be uniquely positioned to deliver to the global community an agenda that brings together the social, environmental, and economic pillars of sustainable development in a unique way. And on the margins of the 68th session of the General Assembly, business representatives came together to form what we're calling the Global Business Alliance for post-2015. It basically will provide to the intergovernmental processes a coordinated voice of business. And one of the overarching elements that we have that comes at the core of our messages are basically 4 catalytic processes that we think are going to be key. They're basically good governance and the enabling environment, inclusive economic growth and economic empowerment, innovation, and investment in infrastructure. But as we say, this critical and overarching precondition for sustainable development is good governance and the enabling environment. At all levels, domestic markets, foreign investment, and international trade, private enterprise requires an operating environment conducive to growth and development, including peace and stability, the rule of law, good governance with accountability and transparency, the absence of corruption, adequate infrastructure, an educated workforce, clear property rights, and enforceable contracts. We feel strongly that business has a critical role to play in accelerating progress toward sustainable development as an engine of economic growth and employment, and as a key contributor of government revenues and as a driver of innovation. Creating that right regulatory environment for business to thrive will have to build on several factors, including a stable macroeconomic and regulatory environment supported by sound fiscal and economic policies, reviewing regulation affecting business to ensure it creates an enabling environment for doing business and has a pro-employment impact whilst also meeting its regulatory purpose, reforming regulations to redress legal and administrative barriers to formalization, better facilitating and supporting the registration and early stage growth of new business, including providing access to credit, financial support, often at the micro level. States must aim at building their local capacity to continually engage in commercial law reform at the country level and in a coordinated fashion on the rule-formulating activities of regional and international bodies. As my colleagues have already previously mentioned, commercial law, depending on how one drafts it, can both promote local productive capacities or make one's local markets less competitive. It can create mechanisms to ensure accountability or may only give the impression that it does so. It can create market incentives for corporate responsibility and good governance or can promote fraudulent activities. It may be an effective deterrent of conflicts triggered by economic factors by addressing their root cause or may trigger conflicts by creating an environment where favoritism and inequalities are involved. An outdated law framework is a major impediment to development. It creates barriers to the formalization of the informal sector of the economy, inclusive finance, innovation, new economic opportunities, public expenditure efficiency and savings, and recovery from financial crisis and other benefits. In the end, it does not allow states to achieve effective mobilization of resources for sustainable development. For me, a key issue is how we bring these issues into the dialogue and how we get member states to understand and to integrate this in terms of either the global development agenda and then once adopted at the national and local levels. In addition to the whole notion of public-private partnerships is a notion of public-private dialogue. And in a sense, the promotion of consensus building through stakeholder dialogue, notably between governments, business, and civil society, is vital for designing effective solutions and for implementing them in practice. They create a shared sense of accountability and responsibility. Such multi-stakeholder cooperation may take place, for example, in the context of creating an enabling business environment. Improved state-business relations can be assumed to contribute to a better understanding of private sector needs by the government and thus to a more efficient allocation of resources in the economy. A government that is informed through regular meetings with the private sector about investment climate problems will usually have stronger ownership for reforms. Being in constant dialogue with private investors is also necessary to enable public officials to assess where markets can be expected to work and where they are likely to fail, and offer or withdraw public support accordingly. This can create trust between the public and private sector, make policies more predictable, and thus minimize the risks for the private sector. It can also lead to jointly planned, financed, and implemented public-private initiatives to deal with coordination failures and public goods. As I mentioned earlier, I think we are at a unique moment historically. And I think that that the United Nations is uniquely positioned to try and deliver to the global community a new development agenda that changes the paradigm. You have the interest of business to engage with government to engage at all different levels, and I think business is committed to working with the United Nations on these processes going forward. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Louise. Apologies, and thank you for pointing out also the role of like a midwife, which ICC played both for the New York Convention and for Ancitron itself. Thank you very much for being here. Unless there are immediate questions for clarification, we would go on, and it's my pleasure to introduce Renaud Soriol to you. Renaud Soriol is the secretary of Ancitral. He holds the position of a director in the International Trade Law Division of the United Nations Office of Legal Affairs. It's this division that serves as the substantive secretariat for Ancitral. He is the eighth secretary of Ancitral, and he has been working for the Ancitral Secretariat ever since 1989. He is a French national, he is a French judge, and he has been educated, amongst others, at the Institut d'études politiques de Paris and at the École nationale de la magistrature. Thank you very much for being with us. You have the floor.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a pleasure to be here among partnering organizations that have been with whom we have been working for decades and sometimes for as long as Ancitral has been in existence. We have heard so far from other speakers considerable support for the argument that the business sector is a powerful player in the context of sustainable development. I do not need to repeat what has been so eloquently said in particular by the two previous speakers, about the role of commercial law, which can function as a positive element, fostering accountability, giving access to credit, giving access to peaceful means of settling disputes, or, if not handled properly, work quite to the contrary and increase the difficulties that are facing the developing world. Against that background, it is very clear that something needs to be done at the international level, and someone globally and locally needs to regulate properly issues pertaining to the private sector. That must happen if the envisaged potential positive impact of the private sector in sustainable development is to happen in reality. That monitoring and responsibility over the development of proper rules of trade law is, of course, no easy task, in particular since the area is extremely dynamic and lies at the juncture of public and private interests. However, support at regional and international levels exists and is available for states. Of course, international rulemaking in the field of international commercial law is the specialty of Ancitral, and it will come as no surprise to you if I tell you that we are of the view that it has proved instrumental in reconciling the interests of various stakeholders operating at the international and local levels in a balanced way and in building the local capacity of states. Standards prepared by Ancitral, for example, have the particular advantage that in their making they are by definition scrutinized by states but also by end users, generally represented in international governmental organizations and non-governmental organizations, both coming from representing the global and the local perspective, and representing the perspective of business, of investment, of local and cross-border trade, and of socio-economic development. When Ancitral functions at best, and of course what I say of Ancitral can to some extent also be said of the International Chamber of Commerce in its own area of codification, for example, of banking practice. When such international efforts come to fruition, they truly provide end users with a state-of-the-art instrument which can truly be regarded as representing what the international community considers at a certain time to be the best international practice for a certain type of commercial activity or a certain type of commercial transaction. Reliance on these standards eliminates problems that may arise from reliance on outdated commercial law, which has proved to be one of the major impediments to development. I would also say that it provides a welcome relief in the context of possibly copying existing laws, existing foreign laws, which has been a particularly unsatisfactory element in law reform in the past decades. Reliance on standards elaborated internationally automatically achieves harmonization of commercial law by eliminating divergences between the different national laws. It is not so much that diversity in itself is bad and that uniformity of commercial law is necessarily always much more than an academic goal. It has more to do with what I said earlier, which is the availability of an instrument which truly represents, at a given time, the consensus of the international community. It also has to do with increasing the confidence, providing reassurance to foreign commercial partners and foreign investors regarding the availability in a certain country at a certain time of a legal standard that is reflective of those best practices I mentioned earlier. Now, I won't spend too much of your time trying to convince you of the benefit of antitrust made law. By being in this room, you are probably already somehow convinced of that. And if not, we probably don't have enough time during this side event to build the case. Let me now turn to perhaps a more forward-looking aspect of my presentation. How are we... what can we do, what can this organization do to bring this effort, this lawmaking effort, more convincingly from theory into practice and from international rulemaking to local implementation? Let me perhaps say just very briefly a few words about our experience in technical assistance over the last decades and the last few years. It is clear that the efforts at producing high-level standards that are truly reflective of international consensus are not enough, and that these efforts must be supplemented by the efforts of local experts in order to meet their local needs. What we are often confronted with is a lack of sufficient local expertise capable of drawing on readily available international standards, tools, and expertise for carrying out commercial law reform at the country level. We are also meeting a lack of sufficient local expertise that is capable of coordinating the position of a state in regional and international rule formulating bodies in order to avoid conflicting rules and interpretation. And here again, of course, I am yet again from a different angle, making a case for antitrust, as I think it is the experience of many among those who have participated in our activities, that the rule formulating activities of antitrust in and of themselves function as a local capacity-building tool, as demonstrated by participation by many countries who are not always as active participants as we would like them to be, but whom we have every reason to believe learn a lot from their participation in the antitrust process. With the result, of course, the long-term result, that they will truly become active players and take more direct ownership of the antitrust rule formulating activity. Now, again, leaving the pure perspective of antitrust and broadening it to this organization as a whole and the promotion of the rule of law from a broader perspective, I think it is our experience from technical assistance activities that the attention of local and global leaders is often diverted to other areas of law. We have often no local counterparts, as I mentioned, but more importantly, those counterparts are generally very busy working on other aspects of building a more favorable legal framework. Coming to the post-2015 development agenda, it is realistic to expect that it will determine country development priorities and corresponding allocation of human and financial resources, like the MDGs did in their time. Can the world afford another 10 to 15 years of benign neglect by countries of the commercial law field? If so, the world has to be ready for missing an opportunity to achieve transparency, accountability, economy, and efficiency in public spending, for example, in the era of public procurement and in many of the other areas currently or recently worked on by antitrust. How can we take the informal sector to the formal sector, not for the sake of tax paying or for the pleasure of paying taxes, but in moving to the formal sector for the benefit of making additional resources available to both entrepreneurs and to society as a whole, if not through eliminating barriers for the formalization of businesses that may exist in outdated commercial law frameworks? And, of course, on that point, I am making an immediate direct reference to the working group that will be meeting in this room as of next Monday for its first session on how commercial law, internationally made commercial law standards, can promote micro, small, and medium-sized enterprises. We could continue. How can the world live with an absence of a proper framework in respect of electronic commerce and IP transactions that was mentioned, alluded to briefly by Professor Lee? Well, we also have standards in that field that must now be implemented and come into reality. How can we achieve that, and how can we express that those policy requirements in the context of the post-2015 development agenda? Well, first, of course, the tendency to work in silos must be overcome. Otherwise, progress in one area of development will continue to be made at the expense of other areas, like commercial law, areas that are less visible, but that are equally important for economic and social development. For example, the discussions on the building blocks of the environment that is conducive to private investment and entrepreneurship should not be centered exclusively around issues of criminal law, international trade policies, and other public law issues, important and as those issues may be. The direct relevance and importance of private law matters should not be disregarded in these intergovernmental discussions in this organization. Thirdly, related processes and area must be linked. In particular, I'm referring to the close link between policy making and law making and institutional reforms, which needs to be ensured. Perhaps a standalone goal on the sound commercial law framework for rule-based business, investment, and trade is much too much to imagine. We have heard that more than 200 goals are already competing for inclusion in the post-2015 development agenda, and it is probably unrealistic and unnecessary to imagine entering that race. What we are imagining is a number of goals with a package of targets attached to them that could refer to the need to put in place a sound commercial law framework for rule-based business, investment, and trade. Targets and indicators relevant to the sound commercial law framework must be built around the quality of legal texts regulating commercial transactions, and refer in this context to the need to ensure that they are based on internationally accepted commercial law standards. The relevant targeted indicators must also ensure that the commercial law texts are readily available, easily understood, and allow for the uniform interpretation and application. Otherwise, these texts will continue not allowing parties to commercial transactions to take commercially reasonable decisions, and thus will fail to serve their intended purpose of promoting legal certainty and predictability in which business, investment, and trade must operate. The relevant targets and indicators must also be built around the swift and effective mechanisms to hold those violating the legal framework accountable, and the need to achieve transparent, consistent, and predictable outcomes in jurisprudence on commercial law matters. Alternative dispute resolution should be available as an option to seek adjudication of commercial disputes in a neutral forum, and the court systems must be equipped with means to efficiently and effectively support such alternative dispute resolution mechanisms. Finally, the relevant targets and indicators must address the need to start educating people as early as possible on issues directly relevant to their employment opportunities and entrepreneurship. Such basic building blocks of any commercial activity, sale and purchase, setup of businesses, etc. Dissemination of the relevant knowledge may need only minor efforts, but produce significant long-term positive consequences for tackling development challenges rooted in economic factors, which of course are of a considerable magnitude when you consider joblessness, youth unemployment, and the shortcomings of a large informal economy. These are some of our ideas developed in much more detail in our written materials. Regardless of what approach is taken to the formulation of the post-2015 development agenda, the message should come out clearly that states must aim at building their local capacity continually to engage in commercial law reforms at the country level and in a coordinated fashion in the rule-formulating activities of regional and international bodies if the envisaged potential of the private sector in sustainable development is to be fully utilized. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. Our last speaker is Edric Selous. He is the director of the Rule of Law Unit in the Executive Office of the Secretary General of the United Nations. Edric has been holding this position since April 2010. Together with his team, he supports the Deputy Secretary General in leading a strategic approach by the organization, by the United Nations, to the rule of law, ensuring greater coordination and coherence in the United Nations system rule of law activities. Initially, United Kingdom attorney, Edric has held various public interest positions around the globe, including for the United Nations, before being appointed director. It's a pleasure to have you here. You have the floor.
Thank you very much to the chair and to Anse Trell for organizing this event. It's most timely, not least because the big red clock outside of the Secretary General's office indicates there's less than 700 days left now to the post-2015 decision. but also because, of course, the important open working group meeting that will be held, that is being held at the moment, which will be considering peace, rule of law, and governance as part of the post-2015 agenda. As you may have seen, if you've looked at the background papers for the open working group sessions, there's an issues brief there that has been coordinated amongst the 40 or 50 UN entities, offices, departments who are working in these areas and have identified the stocktaking, the key milestones within the intergovernmental process that has considered the rule of law in these other areas. And whether it's from the 2005 World Summit or the 2010 MDG Summit or the RioPlus20 outcome document, or most recently in September with the 2012 Declaration on the Rule of Law, all of these documents concluded that rule of law and development are strongly interrelated and mutually reinforcing. So to that extent, clearly, it will be important to include a rule of law element within the post-2015 agenda. Now, to what extent is that to be included? Well, that issues brief identifies for the UN system itself that the rule of law is both an essential condition of sustainable development and a development outcome in its own right. In an outcome of its own right, this has been reflected in a number of other documents, including the My World Survey, which went to an extremely wide set of stakeholders who identified rule of law as one of the top five priorities and for peoples around the world. But in terms of supporting other development outcomes, providing effective, fair, stable, and accountable institutional and legal frameworks, we believe provide the necessary delivery mechanism for all development outcomes. So now, looking to the importance of rule of law in commercial relations, first of all, of course, the interlinkages between a strong rule of law and sustainable development itself are clear and are identified in those papers, whether appropriate legal frameworks foster inclusive economic development by increasing contractual security and reducing corruption. They also allow for transparent and timely resolution of disputes, as we've heard and many speakers have already spoken to. The rule of law widens access to public services and improves management of the environment and natural resources. Similarly, a rule-based commercial relations plays an important role in generating inclusive and sustainable development. Property rights and legal relationships are basic building blocks for any commercial activity in any society. This is why national constitutions should recognize basic property rights. There should also be a fair and independent means of enforcing property rights and legal relationships and of resolving any disputes arising. Legal certainty and predictability depend on enforcement. Weaknesses in the independence and capacities of justice institutions to uphold and enforce rules and adjudicate disputes can be a significant barrier to investment. Mechanisms for adjudicating disputes and enforcing binding commitments in the context of trade and investment must therefore be accessible, efficient, and affordable. Such means should include alternative dispute resolution mechanisms, such as the possibility of arbitration, clearly an area where UNCITRAL brings the most to bear. This is especially important in states which have capacity gaps and where it may not be possible to investors to rely on national courts. The rule of law in commercial relations is thus vital to sustainable development. It provides for a safe environment to engage in productive activities and for institutions and businesses to establish and flourish. It ensures the possibility of enforcing contracts, it regulates labor, promotes opportunities for decent employment, it provides the framework for establishing and protecting small and medium-sized enterprises and promotes access to markets by the poor. So the impact on poverty, the importance of the rule of law in commercial relations can be better illustrated through some concrete examples. 3/4 of the world's poorest people live in rural areas, where land is a key asset. Of those people, more than 1 billion lack legal rights over the land they use to survive, causing entrenched poverty cycles to persist over generations. Improved security of tenure for land and property is critical to ensure economic progress. Land tenure creates certainty about what can be done with the land or property and its use, increases economic opportunities, and benefits through investment and protects from seizure and other encroachments, which often risk fueling larger scale conflicts. Secure land rights make a difference. Research has shown that when these rights are secured, agricultural production increases by 60% and annual family income increases by 150%. At least 40% of internal conflicts over the last 60 years are linked to competition for natural resources. Sustainability and transparently managed natural resources can, however, be the engine for economic well-being. The extent to which countries succeed in negotiating good resource contracts, consulting and ensuring the participation of local communities, regulating the natural resource sector, and using resource revenues for job creation, public services, infrastructure, and economic diversification will define their ability to achieve sustainable development. The rule of law enables the sustainable use of natural resources by enshrining land, environmental and resource rights in constitutions and legislation, enforcing regulations, bolstering environmental protection frameworks, and defining rules for natural resource exploitation and land governance. In terms of UN support, UNCITRAL, of course, is the principal normative UN body in the field of commercial law, and is a natural partner to UN agencies which engage in programmatic support to member states in strengthening this key sector. Given the importance of advancing the rule of law in commercial relations in all settings, from prevention to peacekeeping and through peacebuilding to development, the United Nations has been focusing on its ability to support member states in addressing any national gaps in this area, including through the development of a system-wide guidance on how best to build the appropriate national capacity. And we've heard from Mr. Soriol the importance of building capacity at the national level. It is anticipated that such guidance will lead to better integration of UNCITRAL standards into rule of law strategies, in particular at the country level. The focus of this work can include the strengthening of key state institutions, such as line ministries or parliamentary committees, as well as building capacity of local judges, arbitrators, and other legal practitioners. Support can also be provided to establish arbitration and conciliation centres. It is equally important to address public awareness of these important issues as to support community-based institutions that contribute to economic activity. As the 2012 High-Level Declaration on the Rule of Law acknowledged, the rule of law is cross-cutting and interconnected. Supporting commercial relations based on the rule of law is critical to a range of development outcomes. For example, strengthening commercial relations will also help to address inequalities. In 98 economies, for example, equal inheritance rights were correlated with a higher likelihood of women having formal bank accounts and credit. Securing land rights for women helps in the achievement of a whole series of desired outcomes, whether it's improved income, better nutrition and education for children, giving women a voice within the family, empowerment within the community, and assurance of livelihood in widowhood or divorce. Land rights are important even for such goals as protection against spousal abuse. Advancing the rule of law in commercial relations is both a development objective in itself and works in support of other development goals. This is a message that the Open Working Group meeting this week must hear from you, as they prepare their report to the General Assembly making recommendations for sustainable development goals. Our future development agenda should be ambitious and aspirational. We're, as spoken to by Louise, at a critical juncture where we must have a transformative agenda agreed by all. Our discussion today is critical, therefore, for ensuring that the role of a rule of law and a rule-based commercial relations system to this agenda is clearly articulated and understood by the members of the Open Working Group. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think we have had a very amazing overview over the issues that are raised by the enabling business environment and its importance for sustainable development. Let me maybe just make a personal statement from the perspective of UNCITRAL. UNCITRAL, of course, has an interest in injecting its input and its expertise in the process that is now open before the Open Working Group. But I think the message is also important that UNCITRAL is also an addressee for for decisions that come out from this process. And I would like to draw attention to the, in my view, quite unparalleled parallel expertise that UNCITRAL has developed in breaking down global policy agendas into legal norms. Take, for instance, the example of the working group has been sitting in this room this morning and that will continue sitting this afternoon on international arbitration, that has in few sessions has transformed the claim for transparency in investor-state arbitration into not only transparency rules for such arbitrations, but also into a draft convention that hopefully can be adopted in the course of this year still. So that's an important example of UNCITRAL's ability to really transform global policy agendas into norms, specific norms that carry with them rights and obligations for individuals. Also, as Mr. Soriel has mentioned, next week there will be the first session of a working group that is focusing on developing a legal framework for micro, small, and medium-sized enterprises. And this is really the first time UNCITRAL tackles issues related to commercial law. For the time being, UNCITRAL has had the idea that commercial law issues might be too politically sensitive to be tackled on a worldwide level. And we are here at the moment, and the moment has come for UNCITRAL to embark on this venture. And here we see clearly a developmental ambition behind the work of UNCITRAL. I'm personally very much looking forward to this work next week and the outcome this working group will yield over the next series of sessions. But I wouldn't speak any longer without giving you the floor, without giving you the opportunity to ask questions in this context. To whom may I give the floor? Yes, please.
Thank you. My name is Adam Green. I'm with the U.S. Council for International Business, which is the U.S. affiliate to the International Chamber of Commerce. So I obviously support everything Louise said, and I'm really just speaking to echo it. I really welcome the remarks by everybody. In addition to being the U.S. affiliate to the International Chamber of Commerce, we're the U.S. affiliate to the International Organization of Employers and the Business Advisory Group to the OECD. And I just want to say that among all of those three groups, this issue is a high priority for everybody everywhere within the business community. It is a pressing matter, and everybody is looking, really hoping, that the UN addresses this as part of the Sustainable Development Goals. There are many things that companies can do working within existing systems. Companies are good at working around problems, but there are some things you cannot work around, and this is one of them. Companies cannot work around the lack of the rule of law or informality, the companies we work with are dying for the UN to address informality and the lack of rule of law in a lot of countries, because it keeps coming back as the root cause of problem after problem after problem that invariably in this day and age end up on their doorstep. So the entire discussion of supply chain responsibility really stems from informality, if you go back to the root cause, because it's people outside the legal system or excluded from the legal system, don't have clear legal rights, most of the disputes related to mining issues with mining companies. Again, it gets back to land disputes and the lack of property rights. So companies are very eager for this to be addressed for two reasons. One, because it limits economic growth and therefore the markets that they hope to grow in around the world. And second, because invariably they end up back on the doorstep of most of the companies for people looking for some sort of redress, go to any kind of entity they can. And more often than not these days, they're going to companies to try to resolve issues that at the end of the day they can't because they're issues of the legal structure, the legal environment, and things like property rights that can only be addressed by governments. So just to support you and the work that you're doing and really call for this to be a key focus of what's going on in the SDGs.
Thank you very much. I'm just looking to Louise. Would you like to comment on that, please?
Just to endorse my colleague also, and to see how we can work together to raise to elevate this among as the member states, begin to deliberate, as was mentioned earlier, there are now some 200 goals that are being considered and various targets. What is the best strategy to incorporate this, whether or not it is through targeted targets or whether or not we, there are cross-cutting issues that need to be, embodied into the development agenda? I'll be eager to work with all those here to see how we can bring this forward.
Thank you very much. Yes, please, would you just mind introducing yourself with...
Yeah, my name's John Drexhage. I'm also in the Global Business Alliance and here representing the International Council for Mining and Metals on a consulting basis, keeping track of the negotiations for them. And informality is a huge issue as well for the mining and metal sector, for the extraction sector. And ICMM is comprised of 21 of the larger mining and the constant competitiveness issue, for example, with the informal sector as far as, sustainability standards, environmental standards, labor standards is massive in many of these countries. My question is sort of setting it back, Secretary, you made a number of comments as far as the informality is concerned, and we talked about it in the context of SDGs. What I'm still trying to get my head around is, what does that actually look like as far as an SDG is concerned? What is the specific target that you would want to try and table in terms of addressing the informality issue? And I'm not sure if people have some concrete ideas on that in terms of what exactly that would look like, that's something tangible and where we could bring metrics to that makes some sense. Or is that a very naive question on my part? The second issue that I would want to raise is, while all of this is extremely necessary, it is, at the same time, we all must recognize, not sufficient in terms of addressing the full remit of sustainability. And I think there was some recognition of that. And I think the extent to which this discussion can become more broadly relevant to those other sustainability issues, and not just about the issues around good governance, it's necessary. But clearly, there are sustainability issues in many countries that do have good governance and that do have the rule of the law. And so, to what extent can those institutions also play a role in promoting that? Thanks.
Thank you very much. I would invite the Secretary to respond to your first point.
Well, on the informality, two things. I mean, first, the work of ANSI/TRAL is going to be fairly limited. We are experimenting with our first working group in this area of work, which started from the perspective of assisting with microfinance. We started with this working group from the idea of doing something to promote microfinance, and in identifying what could be done, came that idea came from developing countries. I'm happy to say that they had good experience in one region of the world with helping very small micro enterprises, unipersonal enterprises, and so on, moving out of informality through simplified forms of incorporation. And we are going to look at the feasibility of a universal instrument promoting this simplified form of incorporation for very small, micro, and possibly slightly larger, but still small, companies. Now, that in and of itself won't solve the broader problem of informality, but that is a first step. Second point, which was probably more directly your question, how do you work something on moving out of informality in a sustainable development goal? Well, The problem is we are not in a position to draft any of those. That is the responsibility of states. And as realized, there are many competing goals. Our point is, Antitrust Secretariat's point is, of course, we would like to have one, possibly several goals, mobilizing resources around this notion of the promotion of commercial law and of universal harmonized commercial law. We're probably not going to get that. The point is we don't really need that. We can work with, actually, as we have been working with Millennium Development Goals, we could continue to work and hopefully work better with goals that would be centered around either the notion of rule of law or other notions that would provide a link between commercial law development, good governance, and economic and social development. The solution would probably be not so much in the overall goals, but in the indicators, and of course, when you come one or two levels below, looking at the indicators you will take into account when measuring success under any of these goals, no matter how they are phrased, in their perspective, involving trade law, that of course there we would have specific proposals, which I hope can be taken up by states. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The floor is to Edric Selous.
Just to add on the discussion of how to build in more certainty into the post-2015 agenda through targets and indicators, I think to some extent there needs to be a menu of targets and indicators that are presented for a discussion within the framework of the Open Working Group meeting. For some time, I've fended off or heard or discussed with member states similar questions about what exactly can we do to build in more robust legal frameworks into post-2015 in a way that is acceptable to all and meets the principle of universality, etc., and is relevant to all states. So I think there's some work that we're doing in the rule of law unit in coordinating within the rest of the UN system. Examples of kind of targets and indicators, we're still in the process of producing it, but I hope that that document will be available in the work that will go on after the formal sessions of the Open Working Group is finished. So to try and focus the mind on what are actually concrete suggestions for this and what are the data sets associated with that to show that it actually can be measurable. And I think there's quite a lot of work already undergone within other entities who have statistical divisions and who work with national statistical offices to show that we can do that. We can have targets which do work towards having more better structures, legal frameworks to provide the kind of certainty that business is wanting. I mean, just off the top of my head, the kind of targets that have been suggested are around, in principle, around land registration, for instance, because there's some 30% of land globally is under formal land registration arrangements. And so a target that looks to increasing that percentage, and in particular for disaggregated by gender, would be one that can promote the kind of bottom-up structure that will provide greater capital assets that can feed business and greater certainty for investment at the small business level. So this is just one example, but I hope to have that paper that we can distribute in the sidelines of the informal discussions post next week. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Are there any other questions from the floor? Yes, please. Would you just introduce yourself, please?
So my name is Niall Tierney. I'm the post-2015 lead within the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade in Ireland. In terms of the coherence issues that are being discussed here, the coherence and the relevance of commercial law vis-a-vis poverty reduction, where do you see the prioritization of norms coming out? Will trade and commercial law be reviewed in the light of the eventual SDGs? Will the SDG agenda take priority against which commercial and trade regulations will be reviewed in terms of fit for purpose? And would there be a risk that the SDGs and the trade environment remain relatively parallel as they have been under the MDGs? Thank you.
Can I give the floor to Professor Lee, please, and then to Edric Sellers?
Thank you. I just want to endorse the ideas that have been mentioned by the past several speakers. I think, Mr. Chair, you initiate this working group trying to find ideas that eventually can be incorporated into the post 2015 agenda. And I think, and our secretary has already identified quite a number of things under the roof of a sound commercial framework and rule-based investment environment. I think that is something can be an element attached to the rule of law. And if you look at the work so far produced, they are looking not just the important, why the linkage, but also the nexus, but more importantly, how to turn these elements to bring them into operational under the 2015 framework. And I think, although this afternoon, I think we have a lot of ideas come up, I think the particularly mentioned by our secretary, but some of these ideas, I think, can be in your next week to more concretize and also look at it from the point of view of what really 2015's working group are looking for. They want also targets and measurements. Although personally, I think that is something difficult to address, because the danger is that you're looking for measurements and targets, you forgot how to actually to get there rather than looking at the end result. Now, that said, but I think surely the UNCTAD should have made a important contribution, and particularly if you can focusing on the importance to the developing countries in this regard. As I mentioned earlier, the sustainable development really is a term of art, trying to embrace both developing countries' concerns and developed countries' concerns. And so I think if UNCTAD intend to make a contribution, must bear that in mind. And then irrespective of although there are 200 goals, but I think the sound commercial environment is something that should be added. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Salous, please.
So I just wanted to briefly mention that I do think the commercial side of legal frameworks has not been so prominent in the discussions so far in terms of of providing the kind of legal frameworks and certainty for fostering business as part of the economic development and sustainable growth. So I do think that meetings like this are very important, and that you speak to your colleagues in the development side of your mission who may be following the Open Working Group to really bring this aspect into the discussions. From our perspective, from the Secretariat's perspective, we do see the importance in terms of legal certainty around investment drives growth and can be supported through the rule of law for sustainable development. So we're trying to promote that, but this is an intergovernmental discussion, and unless the member states themselves see the importance of this going forward in the post-2015 agenda, it's not going to form prominently. So I do ask that you raise it with your colleagues in the following the Open Working Group discussions.
Thank you very much. I think we would just have time for a last question. Yes, please.
Thank you. My name is Kilevone Maope. I am the ambassador of Lesotho to the United Nations. And I must begin by saying that I'm new to the United Nations system, and therefore I'm still curious about how things are done here. It seems to me that in this debate, there has to be a common understanding of what is meant by terms here between the developed world and the developing countries. Good governance has been mentioned here, and also the prohibition of corruption. That rule of law is necessary for sustainable development. Now, I come from a country which has had a bad experience concerning the development of infrastructure. At the end of the 19, I mean about 20 years ago, there was a very important infrastructure development in my country called the Lesotho Highlands Water Scheme, which was funded by the World Bank and European institutions. And then several companies from the Western world competed for the job. Then they began to pay bribes to officials in my country, and then they were prosecuted in the 1990s. Now, what I noticed was that there were actually countries in Europe which were encouraging corruption. In one country where a company which was being prosecuted came from, corruption was actually not illegal. It was even the payment of corruption was regarded as a business expense which was exempt from taxation. In another country, the corruption monies were stored there. In other words, the country provided a haven for stolen money. And some officials in my country were actually imprisoned, although there is one of them who is still at large now, having been convicted. Now, my question is, do we really have a common understanding of what these rules are? I mean, do we have a common understanding of what corruption is? When I was looking at the Transparency International's index on corruption, I found the country, which is a haven for stolen monies, being said to be doing very well in terms of governance. I was surprised. How can a country which is actually hiding monies which have been stolen from my country be so high there while my country is low in the corruption scale? So I would like to hear what the speakers are saying about our common understanding, because it's as if this is all talk, just words, and meaningless, unless we really have a common understanding of what we mean here about rules and about governance, good governance, and so on. I think this is what I would like to say about the debate here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Excellency. I wonder whether the person best placed to answer your question wouldn't be Mr. Salus from the Rule of Law Unit. Please.
Thank you, Chair. I think a lot has happened within the world of anti-corruption since the beginning of the 90s. There's been a number of conventions have been adopted and endorsed, including the OECD's Convention Against Corruption, the Council of Europe's Conventions on Active and Passive Bribery, and also the UN Convention Against Corruption, which has created a broad normative framework which includes definitions of both active and passive bribery and corruption. So I think to that extent, the actual normative side of it has been quite well articulated. Of course, the issue comes with implementation. As usual, there's always a gap between the normative framework and implementation. Many of these conventions have fairly robust peer review mechanisms associated with them, which I think has proved quite an effective tool in getting stronger implementation at the national level. I also would highlight quite interesting initiatives, including the UN Global Compact initiative, which includes a strong element on businesses self-regulating them and preventing corruption, incorporating UN normative standards into their work, and that's an extremely broad network of international business. So I think there's a lot has been happening in the last 10 to 20 years to try and provide both the legal certainty in terms of what is the crime involved and also to provide mechanisms that can bolster and support implementation and adoption and regulation at the national level. Thanks.
And an observation, please, by the Secretary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, it's of course a fascinating question that was asked. But here is, just to complement what has been said, ANSI trial has also been adopting a number of standards in the past 20 years, including in the field of procurement, of government procurement, which would have made it, had they been in force in your country, Ambassador, would have made it much more difficult for the foreign companies to engage in the sort of practices you have just been describing, which exist. It's not at all uncommon for a developed country to have to be extremely tolerant of the corruption that takes place abroad. The problem is to make sure that you react to that, and the solution is more transparency and adoption of internationally recognized standards, which are precisely geared towards making this sort of behavior, at least to start with, more visible. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Judith Arenas, please.
Just one very small final observation, which builds on the point that's also been made, which is also to stress the importance of capacity building and having national capacity and providing technical assistance so that countries are actually well placed to actually address the implementation gap that Edric mentioned earlier.
Thank you very much. Ambassador, you very shortly.
I don't think I properly understood. Actually, my country was vigorously prosecuting the criminals. But I'm saying in one European country, corruption was not a crime. So I don't quite understand if it is as if we were tolerant. We were not. We were surprised by the developed world, which has taught us that corruption is bad. That is what I'm trying to say here. And when we engage in these debates, we hear a lot about the developing countries, that they must do this and that. We don't hear much about the developed world. That is the point I'm trying to make here.
Thank you very much, Excellency. And even though I wanted to stop the debate, I have Edric Sellers to my right, and he has the last word. Please.
I do apologize if I didn't make myself clear either. The conventions I'm referring to actually are mainly European or OECD country-based, apart from the UN Convention Against Corruption. and it's focusing on the active bribery. It would have covered, these more recent conventions would have covered the kind of bribery that you're referencing from the European company. So it would have been criminalizing the active bribery by the European company of the officials in Lesotho. And also, just to add that those conventions also cover the loophole that you mentioned about being able to write off bribes as a tax write-off. In fact, that plug has been made in those conventions also. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think it's 3 o'clock and we should free the room for the works of the UNCITRAL Working Group on Arbitration. If you are interested in the statements that were made, you can pick them up at the tables at the side of the room and over there, to your left. If there are not enough papers, you can drop an email to the UNCITRAL Secretariat. At this point, let me thank again the speakers for your contributions, and on behalf of UNCITRAL, AA, LCO, IDLO, and ICC, let me thank you for your interest in the topic, and we look forward to the future debates in the Open Working Group. Thank you very much.